Offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, coming to you live from our studios at Prashant Nilayam, it's Prem and Arvind, and we are here to resume our afternoon satsang on the book Conversations with Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba by Dr. John Hislop, where he very beautifully documents some of the very profound conversations that he has had with Swami. And if you were with us the last time around, a couple of weeks back, when you were doing this, the previous episode of this particular series, you'd have seen how even Swami's students were around the old bungalow then. And if you just heard Brother Sonam's talk just before we tuned in, and we signed in, actually, you would have heard him speak about the old bungalow days. And probably around the same time, this conversation must have occurred, because we could go through those parts where Dr. Hislop was referring to students standing around the bungalow and Swami including them also in the conversation. And the last week we went through that extended conversation where students are part of it. There was the topic of surrender which came up, where each one of the students Hislop would interact with and ask them what they were planning to do in their future. Most of them would say that whatever Swami would say, and he would proclaim how that's a very surprising thing, where youngsters do not have a choice of their own and are ready to do whatever Swami commands them. And I think that was the essence of the conversation that we covered last week. And before we continue with this week's episode, just one thing to add, we are not leaving out any of the conversation which has been documented in the book. And of course, we are trying as much as possible not to add anything more. We are trying to go with the flow, and that's one of the reasons why we are going through a varied amount of topics, because generally for an afternoon satsang, we will take up one topic and we'll go through that in a systematic manner. Here, I think we are freewheeling in the sense that we are going with the conversation, and we can see the conversation itself is covering a wide number of topics depending on the questions being asked and how Swami is letting the conversation flow. So I think that's precisely what we're doing. We'll ensure that we don't leave out anything, because the attitude with which we go through anything, any literature of Swami, is that nothing is trivial, nothing is unimportant. Everything has a profound message. It is up to us to look into it and grasp what is there. So with just those few thoughts, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem. And I remember that last time we were doing this series on the conversations with Sai, we stopped purposely at a very important point. That's because I think that will answer so many questions that arises in so many of our hearts regarding Swami's miracles, Swami's experiences, faith in God, and the like. So we might rewind a little bit back to go to the question where Hislop is asking, how does this faith arise that God is everywhere? This is not actually a question that Hislop is asking Swami. A conversation has developed between Hislop and the other students who are there. And the students are giving answers which some of them are surprising Hislop, some of them are confounding Hislop. So, in course of that conversation, Hislop asks, how does this faith arise that God is everywhere? And one of the students answers, there's some small experience of Swami, then there is faith. Now, the moment the student says this, that is when Swami steps in, and that is where we had stepped out the last time we had done this conversation, because what Swami says is so important, so vital, and something that we should frame on the walls of our heart and keep it. Swami says, no, faith comes first and then experience. So the student is saying something that any one of us automatically say, that, you know, when they ask me or ask you or ask anybody, how did you come to Swami? We share an incident or an experience, something that is bordering on the miraculous or something out of the ordinary, and say that that is what happened and that's how Swami entered my life and that's how he has become my God. While that incident might be true, what Swami says is that faith comes first and then the experience. I think we should spend a little time on this statement, because we often think that, Swami, if you give this miracle, I will become a devotee. When we look at those who are devoted to Swami, who have implicit faith in Bhagwan, we think that they are lucky because they received a mind-boggling experience or a miracle from Swami, because of which they have become devotees. And we also feel that if only I also receive a miracle like that, even if I receive an experience like that, I also will become a devotee. Why is Swami not giving me an experience? That is where the statement we have to remember, where Swami says faith comes first and then the experience. It's like the hen and egg situation, where you wonder whether the hen came first or the egg came first. I think Swami has answered that as well. I'm not clearly remembering, but which occasion and where. But this much I do remember, that I read it somewhere where Swami said, one, again, that although I am not remembering, you know, sadly. But Swami clearly said that the hen came first, or the egg came first. He clearly said it. In the same way, when we talk about whether faith comes first and because of the faith you get an experience, or experience comes first because of which you get the faith, Swami is clearly saying that faith comes first and then the experience. In fact, it is that faith that enables us to recognize an experience as an experience. Let's take a simple case of sitting for darshan and Swami coming, walking around. Or if we take, forget the physical frame days, if we take a time when we are seated in our own centers, in our own mandir, at home, what we experience there has got a lot to do with what we put in as well. That's why in his discourses, Bhagwan would mention, God's grace is the positive, human effort is the negative. When both come, there is a current that flows. Often I used to get confused and mistake this for thinking that God's grace is a positive thing and our effort is a negative thing. It's only much later I realized that when Swami says positive and negative, he is referring to just the polarities, that's all. The polarities that have to come together, that are a must for an electric flow to happen. So Swami says that both are needed. There is something God does, there is something man does. God gives the experience, man has the faith. If it is not for the faith, we will not recognize the experience as a miracle, and you know, we might even if we happen to see it or notice it, we might just brush it away as a coincidence or a freak episode or something like that. In order to feel God's grace and feel the thrill of the miracle and experience, we definitely need to have faith.
And absolutely, I think this is one of probably some things which Swami clears out very, very categorically. And of course, we've had entire satsang on this concept of faith versus experience, which comes first, and Swami's take on it is very, very clear. One of the other ways of looking at it is, you know, when you say faith, what is faith? You know, generally as Swami's devotees, we talk of faith being having faith in Swami, or having the faith that Swami is divine, or whatever that is. But when Swami talks about faith, Swami talks about something which is much, much more fundamental than that. And if I could define it, I think Swami speaks about the oneness, right? Swami is talking about, if divinity comes in front of you, you will be able to recognize him or her in that divine form, because you are essentially that divinity. What you're recognizing is not the reality of the other person, but you're recognizing something which is your own, right? So Swami is saying that oneness is always there. It does not go and come, or it is not created when you undergo an experience. It is always there. It's like something you find under the earth. You know, the digging process does not make it manifest under the ground. It's always under the ground. Your digging process only brings it out from within. It just makes you access that which is already there. And Swami says that's what faith and experience is, the relation between faith and experience. The faith is always there, but it is only an experience which kind of triggers that faith to come out from within, right? So Swami is saying that if that faith is not there, there's no way it's going to come out. So it is always there, and it is whether the experience triggers that. The other way of looking at it, and which is probably an important way of looking at it too, and I think Swami is going to explain that a little further when he goes, where you talk of the heart and the head, right? Swami would often give that difference. And Swami would say faith always comes from the hridaya, or the heart. And the experience or explanation is always for the mind. Because what seeks explanation is always the mind. The mind is the one which is going to ask questions, is going to think objectively. And Swami would say that, you know, when some devotees would find it difficult to accept that Swami was divine or Swami is the supreme divinity, Swami would say it's quite natural, because to look, I'm just like you. Right? I have two legs and I have two hands and I'm moving about doing things just like you. So the mind will look at this scene in front of you and it'll say that this is like any other normal person. Right? So Swami would say the mind is the one which asks the questions. So always experience is, in a sense, to silence the mind and let the heart to do the understanding. Right? So the number of experiences that we've gone through, especially those who come for the first time to Swami, you would see this very, very uncanny similarity in a pattern where the person has doubts, but underneath the doubts, there is this craving to literally accept Swami and say that, you know, I accept and I can see who Swami is. And that craving is almost like, Swami, do something so that this questioning stops, this doubting stops. And I think that is the relationship between faith and experience. And very, very beautifully, I think Swami goes on to explain that to an extent.
Swami says, students must not only know the answers to the questions, the answers must be in the conduct of their lives. And on this basis, they must teach others. So, it's so clear that Swami is emphasizing on practice rather than preaching.
I think this is also from the previous one, right? Sorry to...
There's been a long discussion where Hislop has asked a lot of questions and the students are answering it. So Swami is saying that students must not only know it theoretically to come out very well while speaking, it must also show as conduct in their own lives. And then Swami adds, faith is natural to each person. Each person has some faith in himself, some confidence in himself, and the core of his being, of himself, is Atma. From this comes the foundation of faith in himself. A small example. One does not remember his birth, and his mother tells him the date. He does not know by himself, but through faith, he accepts what the mother says. Father may not have been present at that time, but the mother gave birth. So, Swami is saying that faith is there within everyone, some basic faith. You know, even something as basic as, if somebody asks me whether I have written my will, I have not written my will. And if they tell me, why are you not writing your will? What if you die tonight? What if you sleep tonight and don't get up tomorrow? What if something happens now? Somehow, it is built in that is not going to happen. I am not saying that people don't die young, but somehow we have the faith. Even as I go to bed, if I have the fear that when I go to bed, I may not get up tomorrow morning, I don't think any night I will enjoy a good sleep. Every night when I go to sleep, I'm confident that I'm going to get up tomorrow morning, and that's why that thought is not even there in my head. You know, like that if you extrapolate the same thing, when you go to the barber shop, recently I had been there for a haircut. He's having two sharp blades in his hand and he has... wrapped you up in a towel and you can't do anything, and that blade moves so closely to your throat so many times. You know, what if this person is an evil person? What if he slits my throat? You have faith. It might be appearing trivial when I say it like this, but in all these things we have faith. We have faith in the vegetable vendor. What if those vegetables are poisoned? I mean, if we don't have faith, our days will be a nightmare actually. We won't be able to do anything peacefully. You know, somebody gets me a cup of coffee to drink in the studio or drink at my place of work. What if it is poisoned? What if it is, you know, all these doubts, all these things come, and all these are taken care of just by faith. It's not, there is no concrete proof of anything. There is no concrete proof that there is no poison in the coffee. There is no concrete proof that barber will not slit my throat. There is no concrete proof that when I sleep tonight, I may not get up tomorrow. Because there are many people who actually leave the world that way. They just sleep in the night and morning, they're gone, and that's considered a very blessed kind of death where you felt nothing and you just slept and the sleep transformed itself into an eternal sleep. But this is what I think Swami refers by saying that all of us have that faith. And we show that faith so many times, even in a single day. So that is the fundamental faith that Swami is speaking about. And Swami says that faith comes from the true you, which is the Atma.
And the relationship with Swami gives us very, very beautiful where he talks about the confidence that you have in oneself and, you know, what you very beautifully explained, where it is like the outset of any interaction that we have, or, you know, when we start off, we always start with confidence and faith, right? Suppose you meet a person for the first time and you ask that person, what's your name? The moment that person tells his or her name, we won't think that, is she lying or is he lying? That thought never comes. So doubt always is a layer on top of faith. You know, we always operate with faith, as you said, and Swami would say, that, you know, even if you go to take a cab, you always have faith in the driver. You get into a bus or a flight, you have faith in the person who is driving or flying that thing. So it is always like you start off with faith, but the doubt is always only a layer on top of it. And whatever you experience or whatever you do to clarify that is only to restore you back to that basis of faith. Right, and that is why Swami's teaching that always faith comes first and then experience. I think it's important to understand that. It is not to say that without experience one cannot have faith, or by saying that one does not need faith to have experience. Because one of the things when you go through the early devotees who come to Swami, the kind of experiences they have had is quite unparalleled. And there is no sliver of doubt in any of the kind of experiences they have, right? And especially if you look at what happens during the Chitravati days and all that, you know, the experiences like in front of their eyes, Swami takes sand and converts it into ghee dripping sweet, right? There is no way you can explain that. And Swami probably has selected Puttaparthi in such a way that some of those things are not available anywhere in the nearest vicinity. Right?
But as you said, Prem, you know, this doubt that forms as a layer, we have also seen in the same olden days that within years, those who have come and seen and experienced this, they have also left and gone. So, like you said, doubt is that film. It's a kind of film of dust or cobwebs, whatever we call it, which forms on this faith. And I think sadhana is all about keeping this clean. When they say chitta shuddhi, cleanliness of the chitta, I also think it is like this, keeping the faith clean, keep going on regularly, wiping away that dust, that film which forms on faith, which actually plunges us into doubt and makes us lose our peace of mind.
Right, and this basic idea of faith, you know, in whatever we interact with, and the more we tend to know that person, the more there is no reason for doubt, right? And the explanation which Swami gives you, or the example which Swami gives you, is something of that sort, where he talks about, you know, one does not remember his birth and his mother tells him the date, right? He does not know by himself, but through faith he accepts what the mother says. Even the father may not have been present at the event, but the mother gave birth, right? And then Swami goes on to say, she does not need to ask anyone. Some reflection will indicate that for the coming into being of the universe, there must also be a basis, and God is that basis. He knows. He need not ask anyone. In that subtle area beyond body and intellect, only faith can exist. Faith is naturally with each person, and so also is love. I think we'll go to love a little later, but Swami is talking about two kinds of faith in this, based on what Swami is saying here. One is, of course, is a continuation of that conversation which Hislop was having with that student, where in the previous segment when we were seeing, where he asked this question of, you know, how do you know Swami is God and how do you have that complete faith, where the student says that there is a little bit of experience. So that is one kind of faith. The other fundamental faith which Swami speaks of is the faith in divinity itself, because that is probably more difficult. Right. Even if you're looking at Swami, you can at least establish without any doubt that here is a person who is not, you know, who is at least superhuman. Forget about whether he is God. But Swami is talking about the fundamental faith of the existence of God, where you clearly go by the words of people whom you trust, whom probably you would call rishis or saints or sages or whatever it is.
It reminds me of a story that I had read, you know. It has been attributed to different scientists. That's why I'm not naming the scientists, because I don't know. I've not verified it. But let's say it's just a story. Even as a story, it's so powerful in the message it brings home. It goes that there is this person sitting in the in the train, and as he's traveling, he sees there's another young person sitting opposite to him who is going on staring at the book that he's reading. And the book that he's reading is a religious book. So the young person sitting opposite to him says that, religion is, this is what, this belief in God, that is what has ruined our planet, and it has led to so many false things. You know, the whole thing itself is false, and how do you, you know, they say God created the universe, what nonsense is that, this, that. And he keeps telling all this, and this person sits silent, and towards the end of the journey, he says, if you really wish to discuss in detail about this, why don't you come over home? And then when he hands over his visiting card, this person sees that this is some big scientist. He's a person of repute, and he's very amazed. He's very thrilled. So he says, sir, it'll be an honor. I'll come. And suddenly the attitude changes. But when they go to his home, he sees there is a model of the universe. And it is different from the model that he has known so far. This story is based in the early 1800s. So the structure of the universe, the shape of the solar system, everything itself was undergoing change. So he says, wow, sir, the way you have derived this model, this is amazing. How did you get this model? He says, you know, to tell the truth, I didn't make this model. One night I slept, the morning I woke up, this had come over here. He says, come on, sir, you must be joking. I know it's an idea that you put it into this shape. He says, no. The idea didn't give the shape. It is the shape that gave me the idea. And as I said, the shape just appeared here on my desk. And the student says, and this young lad says, sir, I know you are just, you know, fooling around with me, playing with me. I don't think it happened like that. How can something come out of nothing? He says, then that is when this elderly person says that is how you believe that your universe came into existence. There was a big bang and it came out. It came out of nothing, and suddenly one big bang later and the whole thing was there and everything has happened on its own. If you can believe that such a huge, magnificent, self-sustaining, intelligent cosmos and universe can just be formed one fraction of a second, and then what is your problem in believing that this small thing has just erupted out on its own? You know, it just shows us how hypocritical we are in things that we accept. Like, you know, even the example that Swami says, you believe that you are your mother's child simply because your mother has told you. 2-3 times when I have used this statement, you know, there are some who come back and say, brother, I don't think it is like that because, you know, we have our birth certificate, you know, we have got genetic testing, you know, we can do DNA testing. So my question is, did you do DNA testing then? No, I'm not done. See, that is the thing. You say that there is DNA testing, but 90 to 100, almost 95% of you seated here, none of you have done DNA testing. You just say that DNA testing is there. So does it make your belief that lady is your mother as faith, or does it make it like scientific with proof? You may say that there is a way to check it, but you have not checked it. And even if you check it, Prem, I mean, it leads to other areas. Like, even if I go and do my DNA testing, what is the proof that method works? What is the proof that machine works? I mean, I must have faith in the doctor, right? If the doctor comes and tells us, she's your mother, yes, I got it. How, based on some red marks and blue marks on a piece of paper, I have to have faith in the doctor, or else I must know that science. Even if I know that science, how do I know that machine is operating fine? I must know the operating of the machine. I mean, I must have all the knowledge in the universe to scientifically prove that lady is my mother. Otherwise, I just accept it on basis of faith. I just feel that Swami is also very gently trying to show that if we say that I don't believe in faith because faith is unscientific and I am a man of science, or I believe only in proof, or I believe only in logic, we are actually being illogical, we are actually being hypocritical. I think not so rudely, not so crudely, but Swami is gently showing that by saying that everyone has faith. Faith is the fundamental basis of existence itself.
And talking about forensics and all that, I think recently there was a TV program where we were talking about this, about how using DNA testing and forensic crime, investigation and all that, is now throwing up so many more anomalies than before, where, you know, people are gravitating towards the idea that you cannot completely rely on that for various reasons, right? So when you say that most of the science that we read today I think 10 years back we did not trust in it. Or what we trusted in 10 years back, today we don't trust in it.
Or maybe the same thing what we're trusting today, 10 years from now.
From now will not be trusted. But today we are ready to swear by it. Right? Mm. And it's always there. You know, somewhere you must have drawn that line of faith, as you're saying. Either you believe your parents or you believe the science where DNA matching happens or the lab which is doing that, particular testing or whatever it is. But the other point which comes out here where Swami was talking about, especially when he's talking about the idea of something being the basis for this entire creation. I think this again is a very, very logical thing to look at, right? Because everything that you see in the world today, Swami would give the beautiful example of, simple example of when you write something on the board, right? Swami would say what you write on the board is the adhiyam, what is the blackboard is the adharam. Hmm. Something needs to be the basis, and on that you have something which is temporary. And the adhiyam is always temporary. Today, what you're writing is there. Tomorrow, you rub it and you write something else.
Hmm.
So something needs to be a more permanent basis for the temporary existence. And some would say the same thing with probably trees and plants. Right? The earth is the basis. The earth stays more permanent. Trees and plants and the beings on the surface of the earth are born and they die and they go back. So similarly, if you look at the earth, which is probably a little more temporary compared to the larger universe. So Swami would say that as you go back, you will come to the point by saying that, okay, all of this creation is there and it has a time frame. It might be billions of years, but still it has a birth and a death. So this also must have something which is little more permanent, if not absolutely permanent, behind this. So going by that logic, at some point you will come to this entity which does not have a beginning, does not have an end, does not change at all.
Which call it is by the any adharam. Name.
You know, you call it any name, we are defining it as God. And you would find that whatever else is superimposed on that, that is the basis. And, you know, that is also the basis of you saying that everything else is God. Because everything else is only an appearance on that which appears and goes away.
You can call it God, you can call it consciousness, you can call it love. I remember a beautiful regional song which says that the only difference between an atheist and a theist is that the theist says God is love, while an atheist says that love is God. It doesn't matter if A equals B, B equals A. So whether you call it as God or consciousness or love, it's all the same. And, you know, Swami continues as we saw, Swami led from faith to love. Swami says, faith is naturally with each person and so also is love. Love is directed to various objects and to various persons. But love of God is the essential factor. Looking at that tree, we note the many branches, the leaves, the twigs that are there on the trunk. I'm sorry. Looking at that tree, we note that the many branches, leaves and twigs have the one trunk as the factor that is common to all of them. The trunk in turn relies on the roots. To try to water each leaf and each branch would take so much time and the water would be wasted. But if we direct all the water to the roots of the tree, then each branch and leaf and twig will naturally receive moisture in the way that is best for it. As it is now, people say that they love friends and relatives but do not love God. God is the basis of all individuals. He is the root from which you have... He is the root from which all have their being. It is best to love God first and to love Him with all one's heart. Then your love will naturally include the various individuals.
And such a very, very profound and beautiful analogy which Swami is giving. I think in some other discourses also he gives this. And Swami would add that, you know, the modern day man is only fascinated by the flowers. And the flowers do not have a basis at all. If you look at it, you know, compared to the life of a tree, it is so much more fleeting. And compared to the life of the tree itself, Swami would say the root is the most important thing. And I think this is a very beautiful example which the Gopikas give Krishna in the Srimad Bhagavatam. When Krishna tells them that, you know, why have you come away to the banks of Yamuna? Go back, your husbands are waiting for you, your mother and fathers are looking out for you. So the Gopikas tell this to Krishna. They give the analogy and say, you are like the root. So any love that we direct towards you will definitely reach all of these branches and leaves.
It makes so much sense, and actually it gives us so much solace also, you know, that because in a day, if we look at it in a day or in our day-to-day life, when we talk of different people, we spend so much of time, effort and energy in maintaining relationships. And, you know, if somebody is upset, if some misunderstanding is there, all of this, we try to go and set it right. And as Swami says, that is equivalent to, you know, tending to the flower, the branch, the leaf, the twig. Instead, Swami says, if you are able to love God, which is the root, that is the divinity that is present in all, automatically the others receive the nourishment. I think if we are able to truly be selfless like this, you know, I am watering the root and I am sincere in my love for God, automatically we will see healing taking place in all the relationships. We will see things improving in all relationships, the misunderstandings reducing. In fact, many times people ask whether loving God means becoming a renunciant and cutting off ties with the world. From whatever little experience I can speak, I feel that loving God in fact helps you, you know, blossom each and every relationship in your life in the most beautiful and peaceful manner possible. You will be able to enjoy every relationship, whether it is a friendship, whether it is between the parents and children, whether it's between you and your children, whether it's between you and your wife, whether it's between you and your husband, whatever be the uncle, aunt, in-laws, all the relationships will become more meaningful, much more loving, much more peaceful when we offer our heart to God. So in that sense, I think the Gopikas were the most wise. They struck gold. They struck the truth when they said, "Oh Krishna, you are the root. We water you and everything else is taken care by itself."
Right. And if you look at this entire discussion, it again goes back to, at some point an assumption has to be made. You know, when you talk about faith, one thing is, yes, faith is fundamental. It is there within. It need not be questioned. But at some point, you know, an assumption has to be made and, you know, you work upon that. You know, even when you talk about the existence of God, an assumption is made as to, you know, the nature of God. You know, he looks like this, or this is how he is, or this is where he lives. Something to start off with. That's what Swami would say, that every deity that you worship or any form that you worship is for that. That you have some way to hold on to, and then when you explore, you will come to, you know, the reality of that form, of that being not what it is, and or that being only an orifice through which you are looking at the entire you know, glory of God. There's one very beautiful term which I think Karl Marx uses. He says, you know, we talk about monotheism and we talk about you know, multiple gods, polytheism in that sense. He would say Indians do not follow polytheism as it's generally spoken about. I think he uses a term called henotheism. He says God can be worshipped in any number of forms and each form is equally potent as any other form. He says it is not the belief that God is multiple in number, but there are multiple ways of worshipping the same God. And he uses that word, and typically that's what it is, that you start off with the faith of something, that something, that this is the basis for God, and that faith will lead you to the complete experience or the complete ability to see God in his reality. I think we'll take a break at this point because the discussion changes course from the next question that Dr. Hislop asks. So dear listeners, don't go away. We're going to come back to you after this bhajan and continue this conversation.
Shanta Brahma Maya Divya Swarupa Yuga Vatara Parama Dayaghana Dina Jana Karuna Sai Dina Janavana Karuna Sai. అంతరంగ సాయి అనాథనాథ సాయి
అంతరంగ సాయి అనాథనాథ సాయి
అంతరంగ సాయి అనాథనాథ సాయి సింధు సాయి దీన బంధు సాయి కరుణ సింధు సాయి అంతరంగ సాయి అనాథనాథ సాయి కృష్ణ శివ శక్తి ప్రేమ రూప సాయి రామకృష్ణ శివ శక్తి ప్రేమ రూప సాయి యుగావతార బాబా శ్రీ సత్య సాయి సత్య సాయి అంతరంగ సాయి అనాథనాథ సాయి దీన బంధు సాయి కరుణ సింధు సాయి అంతరంగ సాయి అనాథనాథ సాయి రామకృష్ణ శివ శక్తి ప్రేమ రూప సాయి
రామకృష్ణ శివ శక్తి ప్రేమ రూప సాయి
యుగావతార బాబా శ్రీ సత్య సాయి అంతరంగ సాయి అనాథనాథ సాయి
వెల్కమ్ బ్యాక్ డియర్ లిసనర్స్ వి కంటిన్యూ ది కన్వర్సేషన్స్ విత్ సాయి And now we begin with Hislop asking Swami. Swami, when the college boys give speeches, they say that Swami gives them the words. Can this be correct? Swami replies, Sai gives the confidence. With confidence, the words arise automatically. Then Swami asks the college boy, what do you want to do when you finish college? But coming back to this, I think this is so beautiful. I remember, you know, when Swami says about confidence and Swami gives the confidence, the words arise automatically. There is this beautiful poem where Swami says, the bird with you, the wings with me. Is it? Or the wings with you, the bird with me. Yes. The wings with you, the bird with me. And there are so many things that Swami says. One of them is this, so are we bound, so are we free, Swami says. And I always used to wonder, what is this? What is this? Wings with you, bird with me. You know, I used to always get confused with this one statement, because the other statements make a lot of sense, where Swami says, the light with you, the way with me, whatever. It almost feels like you have to put in certain effort and the result you get. It matches nicely, except for this one. I wondered, what is this, the wings with you, the bird with me? Then, you know, with relation to this very statement, there was a story that Swami had once narrated in 1995. I think 1995, yes. During, that was the 60th birthday. And the 65th birthday.
65th, right.
1995 was 70th birthday.
70th birthday.
Yeah, 70th birthday. So during the 70th birthday time, Swami gifted all the students by giving them interviews class-wise. And to the 5th standard students, he narrated a story. A story of a little sparrow that was sitting on a tree. And Swami said that a storm started and the whole tree began to shiver and shake, quiver and quake. And you know, we know what kind of a dramatic storyteller Swami is. And finally, Swami gave a dramatic pause when he said that the storm brought down the tree. What happened to the little sparrow? And all these little children are waiting with bated breath to know what happened to the sparrow. And Swami, in almost an anticlimactic fashion, says, nothing happened to the sparrow because it flew away. The story might have been anticlimactic because the climax was going to come after that. Swami said that, you see, the world is the tree. And you are like that little bird. If you rely on the tree to give you support and take care of you, you don't know when you can come crashing down. But you must rely on your own wings. And Swami said, what are those wings? Swami said, those wings are faith and self-confidence. It is so amazing that Swami gave faith and self-confidence, because on the face of it, it looks like faith and self-confidence are opposite things. Because self-confidence seems to indicate the confidence I have in myself, that is within me. And faith shows the confidence that I have on an external agency, you know, that is God. So what do you want? It almost comes like a question to Swami as to, Swami, what do you want me to have? Do you want me to have faith in you or confidence in myself? And here Swami is saying, you need both. And I think it is only Swami who can harmonize this and say that, you know, faith is the confidence in the Lord who is outside, you know, or whom you consider as separate from you. And self-confidence is nothing but the faith in the Lord who is within you. It is the same Lord who is within and without. Swami would give the example of a balloon. And Swami would say that when you blow it with air, there is air in the balloon, it is the same air outside also. But it is the air in the balloon that gives the shape of a balloon. And Swami would say that is what is conscience, conscious and consciousness. Swami would say that when that whole air, a part of it is taken, that is what exists in you as the conscience. It is the same as the divinity outside. So also is the case of faith and self-confidence. They are not opposing. They are the same thing. When you have it on the air which is within the balloon, it's called self-confidence. On the air which is outside of the balloon, it's called faith. And Swami is saying here that that is what it is. Swami gives them the confidence. And it is that confidence that automatically gives rise to the words. Because I think Hislop was trying to ask whether, you know, they are able to see in their vision, they are able to see that words flashing or something like that. Because the college boys are saying that Swami gives them the words. So Hislop is eager to know how is it that the words are given. And Swami is saying that when Swami gives them the confidence, they feel connected to Swami, automatically the words arise spontaneously. This is again a very, very significant statement, because that is how, you know, when we talk of the Ten Commandments that Moses received or the Vedas that have been seen by the seers, I think this is how it has happened. In that moment of connect with divinity, automatically sound takes form of words and comes out, and those words are so inspiring. Many times I'm sure we also might have had this experience where we ourselves listen to or see the words that we have spoken or written, and we wonder whether we were capable of it. Those are the moments when we realize that all we need to do is get that connect. Once that connect is established, automatically the words arise. And this is what we mean by saying Swami is the thinker of my thoughts and Swami is the speaker of my words.
Very true. I think one thing about whatever Swami is saying here, or in fact whatever explanation that Swami gives, the commonality or the basic thread which runs through all of that is this idea that you're fundamentally and essentially divine, right? Even when Swami speaks about his philosophy of education, he'll always say it's educare, it is bringing out from within which is already there. The values which are there and the knowledge which is there. Always it is spoken of as the highest seat of knowledge is within, the purest form of love is within, the purest form of ananda is within, everything is within. Always Swami speaks of that, and everything else Swami speaks of is only a means by which you're reaching out to something which is already yours. And this idea of Swami saying that, you know, I only give the confidence. We've seen this happen. You know, it is not purely of Swami transferring some kind of knowledge to a person. We've seen so many students, and in fact, we've had the opportunity to witness literally some of these talents blossoming in Swami's presence. Mm. People who would have come with a little bit of talent or a little bit of learning somewhere, be it musical, be it the ability to play some instrument. Sometimes they would not even, you know, claim to be a musician or something like that, and Swami will pull them up. They might have had some interest long back. But the way Swami would just give encouragement, just giving confidence, it's purely like when Swami says, I just give them the confidence. We've seen that happening in front of our eyes, where the boys who are very, very afraid to give, you know, stand in front of an audience, becoming very, very good speakers. We've seen people who are very hesitant to even sing a song, just purely by the encouragement and love that Swami would shower on them. We've seen the growth phenomenally, so that, you know, then Swami would kind of dramatically give a closure to the entire thing, where probably an elderly person or a great artist would come and say, Swami, even I cannot sing like this, or, you know, this is stupendous, I've never heard anything like this. And it's not, those are not empty words. They would really say that, you know, there's something that Swami has done because of which this person has excelled.
You know, that divine love is so, so special. And you call it confidence, you call it a moral boost, you call it enthusiasm, you call it encouragement. It is nothing but selflessness, selfless love, wherein, you know, Swami never thought, what will I get if I do this for this person? I will just do it because it benefits that person. I remember reading a story, again, the names I don't remember, of a person going to a world famous, world renowned artist and showing him some paintings and asking him what he thinks of those paintings. And this artist says that it's a good effort, but you know, they're okay. There's nothing out of the world or great about them. It's good effort. You have done a good effort painting them. Then he says, sir, let me show you some more paintings. And he opens his bag and pulls out some more paintings and asks, what do you think of these, sir? He says, now when the artist sees this other paintings, he said, no, whoever has done these are awesome, you know. There is, of course, there is a lot of raw talent there. If that raw talent is honed and properly tuned, this person whoever has done these paintings has the makings to be a great artist. And the person says, okay, thank you so much for your opinion. And he keeps the painting in and he's walking out, and this artist calls and says, no, tell me, I would like to meet the person who did those paintings. And he says, sir, you are meeting him, sir. He says, you did those paintings? Yes, I made those paintings. He says, then why did you come and show me somebody else's paintings in the beginning? You should have shown your own paintings. He says, no, sir, these are also my paintings. Then he says, these are the paintings I have done now. Those are the paintings I did 10 years ago. And he says, wow, they had a mark of genius. He says, I only wish I had met you 10 years ago, because this is what has happened. You know, I did not receive encouragement. I did not receive love. I did not receive, you know, any kind of enthusiasm, because of which I have become this today. You know, when I think of the story, I feel the story could have gone both ways. You know, this person could have shown that these paintings, which you say have no hope or no future, these were the paintings I made 10 years ago. And the paintings which you say that they are a little raw, but they are awesome and they have got a great future, those are the paintings I have made now. The difference is, I met a master, an alchemist, who touched my heart and I have grown like this. This is what I think each one of us who have been touched by Swami can say. Because whatever we are excelling in, whatever we are wonderful in, or whatever we seem to be doing amazingly, when we look back at our own lives, I don't think it was anything out of the world. And again, as you said, it's not like Swami manufactured a miracle, he tapped on the head and suddenly people became geniuses. No, I think Swami, to show the power of selflessness and pure love, did it the way any human can also do it. You know, with patience, with love, with tolerance, with acceptance, kept encouraging, most importantly, selflessly. He never thought of anything that he is doing for anybody as an investment which he will reap the rich rewards of in the future. He just did it. And that is the reason Swami could continue to do it year after year, when even, you know, people whom in our words we call as he has invested in, let go of Swami, or, you know, turned away or did not seem to show give any dividend also, Swami did not bother, because the basic fundamental thing is that is selfless love. And it is that selfless love only which manifests as confidence, which manifests as enthusiasm, which manifests as talent, which manifests as capabilities. And I think all of us who have been touched by Bhagwan like that, we are so grateful to Swami for that. And that is what the student also is referring when he says that Swami gives the word. Swami, I mean, you get so overwhelmed with what Swami has done to you. You know the truth that, Swami, whatever I am in life today is because of you. And that is why you say that my words are yours, Swami, my actions are yours, whatever I am getting today is because of you. So in that sense, in that spirit, it is really the case that everything belongs to Swami. Of course, if you see it legally, technically, yeah, it might be your own possession, you have earned it, it might be an award that you got. But in the heart of heart, you know that it's all dedicated to Bhagwan.
I'm reminded of a conversation I had with an old student. And I think in the 80s, he was in Swami's school. Hmm. And this boy comes from, I think, one of these North Indian states, Bihar or Jharkhand or something. And he said when he joined, he had enormous difficulty in speaking in English. And, you know, he used to be made fun of and all of that. And Swami randomly picks him up and Swami tells him that, you know, you should start giving talks. That was a time when, you know, Swami used to call boys who used to give talks during Dashara and all that and spend a lot of time in training them. Swami would say, you should stand like this, you should start like this, this is how you should start your speech. Swami used to train all of them. And, you know, in some very beautiful fashion, I don't want to go into the whole thing, it's a long story, where Swami hints to him that, you know, I am giving such a chance to those who come up and want to become speakers. Don't you want to avail this chance? Mm-hmm. Right? Almost like tempted him with that. Forget whether you're a good speaker or not, whether you'll be made fun of or not, all that. But here is a chance in front of you. You don't want to make use of that chance. So that pricked him. He said, hey, no, let the whole world make fun of me, but I should, you know, somehow manage to become a speaker just so that I get that opportunity. And, you know, that's what happens. Eventually, Swami chooses him for one of the Dashara talks. And he says that that was probably the most nervous few minutes of his life. And he struggled a lot. And, you know, the closure which I was speaking about, where you see the whole circle coming around. Today, that person travels all around the world and he calls himself a personality coach. He says, and he trains people in the corporate how to give presentations and how to carry oneself in meetings and all of that.
Wow.
Right? You know, that is the kind of transformation, purely just that somebody telling you, and as you rightly said, somebody absolutely selflessly telling you that they believe in you. Right, that makes a lot of difference, and we've seen even normal teachers able to bring the best out of a student with that kind of confidence. And when you talk about selflessness being one of the important components of that, you're talking about Swami, who was the very embodiment of selflessness. So it's no miracle that Swami was able to bring about such transformation in students.
You know, one of the common refrains in the Satsai organization or anywhere else also, I think generally this might be the thing, that we want to attract the youngsters, we want the youth to come in. I think Swami has shown the way how to do it. You know, you just have to be selfless. That is rule number one. That is the point number one. Possibly we find it hardest to follow. When I am, supporting a youngster, or I'm saying youngster because they have a whole life ahead, and that seems to be the focus of every organization everywhere. You know, not only organizing, you know, even country-wise. People say India is a young country, this is an aging country, so therefore the demographics of this country are very supportive for its growth. So, more or less it's accepted that if we want growth, you need youth. You need the energy of the youth. And when we wonder how to get the youth, we realize that it is not through any other way, but in being selfless, in being supportive, in being genuinely interested in the full-fledged growth of that youth or that youth member. And when that happens, automatically things happen, because that is how Swami has shown it all through his life. And I feel when we are thinking as an organization or as anything, if we want to bring about a change, we definitely have to exhibit genuineness and selfless love. That is the message I think should be taken by the elders. And for the youngsters, I think the message that we can take is God is always there to support. God is always there as a support. God's love is selfless. So don't turn anywhere else for inspiration. Don't turn anywhere else for motivation or whatever you say. Turn only to God. In fact, that comes a little ahead as well. Not just motivation and inspiration. Swami says that it is your right to turn to God for everything. But for that, I'll be jumping the gun. So let's move ahead with the conversation. Swami asked this college boy, what do you want to do when you finish college? And the student says, I only want to merge in Swami. And again, Swami responds to that. Now the avatar has taken a body to revive Dharma. He is here, engaged in that. So what is all this talk of immortality and merging? Your whole life is before you. First, find out what is the purpose of this life. If God himself is here to foster Dharma and you engage yourself in the same task, then you are worshipping him. Then you are near and dear to him, for you are serving him, his devotees and yourself.
It's a very, very beautiful interaction here. Two ways of looking at it. I mean, I will tell the way which probably is not the way we'll have to look at this conversation. And that is, sometimes Swami's response is purely based on the, you know, the background of the answer which the student is giving. Mm. Right? I think we went through that even when we were talking about the interaction between Swami and the students in the previous episode we had done on this, where sometimes, you know, Swami would respond to the emotion behind it. Sometimes it's a, you know, technically that this is the answer that needs to be given. Mm. And then Swami would respond to that. Swami would not agree with it, or Swami would, you know, brush it aside by saying, and one of the standard things which Swami would do is, you know, catch a tuft of his head and say that, Intamandi Chusandra. He said, you know, don't do all this Dhamma in front of me. I've seen so many people. But I think it's not right to dismiss this particular interaction in that manner. Because what Swami is saying here is very, very important. I think it's so profound and beautiful where Swami says, you know, God himself has come here for a task. And this opportunity to participate in the task that God has, you know, assigned for himself is even greater than aspiring for liberation. Right. Mm. This is such a profound message, especially for all of us who are in some small way associated with Swami's work. I think this is such a beautiful thing that Swami is saying. Because, you know, in the long sense, I think somewhere many, many times Swami has said this in discourses. And I think I myself have heard it a couple of times where Swami said, who are you to ask for moksha? Asking for moksha is also selfishness. Mm. Go and serve the people, Swami would say. Because, you know, this is an opportunity which is much larger than that. You know, seeking moksha and seeking the ultimate is probably, and hopefully we've been doing it for, you know, many, many births even before this one. Mm. Right? This is an opportunity which probably will not come ever so often.
I also think another way of looking at the same thing is that when Swami says that I have come to revive Dharma, so it's almost like there is a war that goes on between the dharmic forces and the adharmic forces. That is the case even when we look at Krishna avatar. There is a war. There it's a literal war that happens, but Swami has many times alluded to in his discourses saying that the war of Kurukshetra is actually what happens within each of us. Dharma kshetra, Kurukshetra. Swami would say that this body itself is a Kurukshetra. This world is a Kurukshetra. And Swami has explained it by saying Kuru is means karma, action. The kshetra where you do action, that is the world. Action is inevitable. You can't escape action. So, therefore, Swami would say that our day-to-day life is a Kurukshetra. It is a battle between dharma and adharma. And in this battle or the war that takes place, you cannot be a bystander. You cannot say, I am not on adharma's side, but I don't want to do anything. I just want moksha. You can't. Because as it is said, there cannot be a bystander in a dharmic war. Either you are on the side of the dharmic forces or you are adharmic. That's it. You choose. Either you are on Krishna's side or you are against Krishna's side. Even saying that I will be neutral and not participate in either still means that you are against Krishna. Because the only way to say that you are for Krishna is to say that you are for Krishna and be on Krishna's side. And that is what Swami is saying here. If you say that, you know, you want Swami, you have faith in Swami and you want to be near to Swami and you want to be dear to Swami, then you have to do what Swami says. That's all it is. You can't say that, Swami, I am not doing what you say is bad anyway. but I will not do this also. I'm not interested in all this seva, bhajan. No, Swami, I don't want to do all this. I just want my moksha. Swami is saying that is wrong. That is not the way. Means if you say that this is what Swami wants, that is what you have to do. And for doing that, Swami will give you the ultimate. That is what Swami told Bhagya sir in an interview. Where, you know, Bhagya sir actually said the same thing. Saying that, Swami, I have understood that you are the divine and I have understood the purpose of life is to find out who am I. I don't want to do all this. Of course, I am giving a synopsis of what happened. These are not the exact words. But he said, Swami, I don't want to do this teaching. I don't want to do a prophecy. I don't want anything. I just want to realize my oneness with you. And Swami replied back, with bloodshot eyes, as he says, that if you separate things as worldly, divine, Swami's work, not Swami's work, then even in 1,000 lifetimes, I shall not give you what you seek. And therefore, then Swami told him that you go ahead and I have given you this task. Take this as your sacred task. Take this as your worship. And I think that is the reason why even to this day, at his age, Bhagya sir continues to be such an inspiring and amazing person. Anytime, you know, when I feel low, one of the people whom I turn to is Bhagya sir. Just listening to him, just feeling the love that he has for Swami brings back so much of inspiration. And I don't think he's doing anything less than possibly any other spiritual guru in the world is doing. And it is no wonder that Swami has placed him where he is supposed to be. So you can't be a bystander and say, I'm not interested. As Swami says, when the avatar has come, we have to align ourselves with what the avatar says and do what the avatar tells us to do.
I think this is something which Swami would often say, what you're referring to about Bhagya sir. I think another senior professor, I think retired professor from the maths department, he was telling that one of the first few interviews which he got, I think in the early years of the university itself, Swami had called his family and Swami had called another family and of some overseas devotees. Swami materialized the Rudraksha Mala for one of the gentlemen sitting there. And, you know, he was very fascinated by that. And he looked at Swami and said, Swami, give me also a talisman. He said, and very innocently, not in a greedy sense, because he thought that it's such a moment, you know, when you are in an interview room with Swami, you know that anything that happens there, if it can be materialized in the form of any object, you know, even if it is a picture of Swami, if Swami gives, that becomes like a memory crystallized in that object, right? So maybe in that sense, he said, Swami, give me a talisman. Swami looked at him and said, Niku talisman ledi emi ledu. He said, I'm not going to give you any of that. Swami told, you know, pointed to his children who were sitting in the interview room, and Swami told, see, all these kids who are here, these are your Kama Putras. You know, children born out of your desire, Swami said. And those children who are sitting outside, referring to his students who are sitting outside in the portico, Swami said, they are all your Prema Putras. Go and serve them, take care of them, and do Swami's work. What you're talking about talisman, Swami will give you everything that you need in this life. Right? So Swami is not telling, I will not give you moksha. Swami is not telling that you will not get it. But you don't even have to worry about it, because the opportunity in front of you, if grasped, is going to give you everything that you can imagine asking, and you which is probably not even there on your list, right? That is what Swami is saying.
On that note, dear listeners, we will take another quick little break, because again, after this point, the topic totally flips, turns over, it becomes, in fact, it's another occasion itself. So we will take that up after this little break.
Namo Sai Deva. Jaya Jaya Namo Prema Bhava.
Bye.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are in the middle of a very beautiful conversation, and as we just said, that part which we concluded was about Swami speaking about the student who said that I want to merge in Swami, and Swami was kind of discouraging him by saying that, you know, here is an opportunity where the Lord Himself is here and you have to grab this opportunity and serve instead of worrying about what would happen after your death. Hereafter, there's a break and there's a different set of conversations which begin where Hislop asks some things about some developments which are happening in the ashram. It's quite interesting because when you go through this, you kind of have an idea of how many changes have gone through, and one thing you can say with absolute certainty is Swami has never sat silently, right? Mm-hmm. Something or the other, and constantly wondering in what way he can, you know, make his time and the time of those around him useful to the people, either the locals or the people around. Mm. And I think that comes out so beautifully in the conversation which follows. We'll probably read out a few of them and we'll see how many we can cover. Hislop asks about Prashantinilam. He says, Swami, what is the new construction on the other side of the sheds? And Swami replies, that is an oil pressing plant. farmers in this area can bring their groundnuts and press out the oil free of charge. And Hislop continues, Swami, I heard that Swami was making a cottage industry for the villagers in these large sheds, but I did not know about the farmers. And Swami replies, in fact, the Gokulam is also a model dairy to show the farmers. The cottage industry is to free the villagers from their poverty by showing them how to work and have a income from that work. So a couple of things which Hislop was asking about, it just takes me back to the other conversation where Hislop talks about how the villagers were given 6 times the promised money for the land they offered to give Swami. And even then Swami was trying to tell them that, you know, this is not an excess that I'm giving on you. This is so that you can start a business and you can do something worthwhile with it. You know, but that doesn't stop Swami from saying that, you know, I've given you money, now you take care of yourself. He's also looking at how you can do things by which you can make others, people's, you know, livelihood worthwhile. And this again, I mean, this is probably in the 70s. The same thing Swami would tell over and over again when he would come to speak to the business studies graduates, the MBA students. Swami would say that, you know, you should try to take up the, you know, setting up some industry or some small factory so that you can employ people, not merely you going and becoming a you know, management employee in a big company or an MNC.
In fact, Swami would say that MBA is MMM. And I think that theme is repeating itself today. Swami said MBA should actually become MMM, which stands for Master of Man Management. And Swami would say that this man management is what will bring ultimately success, goodness, prosperity, wealth, all the positive things that we speak about. And therefore, as a manager, Swami would say, when you take up a project, look how you can benefit the maximum number of people. There should be that genuine desire to do good for everyone. And along with that, Swami would say that treat your men most perfectly and wonderfully. Because Swami would say that men are more valuable than all the things in the universe. Swami would say that as a manager, you might not have expertise in the work that you're taking over. But all you need to do is manage the men. If you are men meaning people, if you are able to do good human resource management, Swami would say the people themselves will do everything that you need to do. You need not have any skill set, you need not have any ability, nothing. Only you need to treat people well. And we saw the same thing a little before also in the discussion, how Swami through his selfless love has encouraged so many people. So that is what Swami, you know, whether be it the MBA class or be it with the farmers, that is what Swami is always doing, thinking how I can benefit others, how I can do good for others. I think that is such a very inspiring thought for us to imbibe in life. If we look at it, you know, from a worldly point of view also, this is what Swami has done all his life, and see what happened. From a poor village boy who couldn't afford 2 meals a day, he became God to millions of people around the world, simply with selflessness and love. That should be an inspiration at least to imbibe part of that selflessness. Part of that selflessness meaning there's nothing like 50% selflessness, but sometime in the day, sometime in the week at least, can we do something selflessly? You know, the conversation continues there where where Hislop asks, the large shed beside the new high school that Swami is building, what is that for? Again, Swami says, there the students may learn skills to help them in a practical way. How to fix machines, carpentry, electricity, plumbing, construction of buildings, so on. And Hislop asks, will that be a feature of all the schools that Sai builds? Swami says, yes. And girls will learn sewing and household skills. You know, this is so important when we look at our integral items, what we call as integral education in hostel, the things that we learn. Many times I wondered, Prem, you know, when I come out of college, I know the Pythagorean theorem and Pythagoras theorem and these things, which I have never used in my life so far. Of course, there will be some people who use it, but I'm speaking generally. At the same time, I would love to know how to drive, how to cook for myself, how to file my taxes, how to invest money wisely, properly. None of these things are taught in our education system. I'm, of course, when I'm speaking, I'm not an expert on the education systems across the world. I'm talking generally what we see in India, where I have gone through. It is only Swami's educational systems that given this practical knowledge as well, how important it is. You know, I might get a great job and I'm put in some place, I don't know how to cook. What do I do? I mean, marrying for the sake of getting somebody to cook, I think it is demeaning the way we are looking at women. It is also at the same time a wrong purpose. A marriage is not for that. But these are situations that we get into, and I have often wondered, why doesn't our education system teach something practical? Like, as I pass out of 12th grade before I joined college, why can't one period in the university or class be reserved for learning how to drive? All these practical things, and it's amazing how Swami's education, Swami has thought of all this. This is so phenomenal. As I said, even if we look from a worldly point of view, leave aside the fact that Bhagwan is divine, it is so thoughtful, so amazing. What vision Swami has, hats off, it's so amazing.
Absolutely. And in a way, if you look at it, I think some of these changes we have seen even during the short period we've been in Swami's university. There are two things which Swami would say. I mean, talking about the educational system itself, Swami had all of these plans of, you know, you would have some of Swami's devotees coming in teaching photography to the students, carpentry to the students. There were some people who were very, very good at that, and music to the students. There would be some music maestros who would come and offer their talent to the students. But over the years, you know, the moment you say that this is a university, it is recognized by the government body, which kind of gives you a certificate. And all of that, they have their own mandatory requirements of how many hours of classes you should have and how many days or working days you should have. And Swami used to always balance it in that manner. He would say, no, whatever the government says has to be followed. You know, the rule of the law of the land should always be honored. You know, that was Swami's way. But within that, whatever was possible, Swami was doing. That's why I think by the time when we became students, it was much, much more regularized than, you know, whatever Swami is telling here about, you know, there's going to be a skill center where people can go and learn all of that. But in a way, Swami ensured that all of that seeps into the hostel schedule itself, where we would have some of these boys who would be in the maintenance department, where all electrical work within the hostel would be done by them. And even today, at least in Radio Sai, we have two people from the erstwhile maintenance group. And we know how hands-on they are. They are so reliable in anything. You want anything to be pulled down, anything to be put up, you just have to put a word and they'll be able to do that. And just that comparison you can make out how much we lack in skill compared to somebody who is participating in activity like that in the hostel. So in many, many ways, in fact, till the 1970, even till the mid-1980s, the entire serial lighting of the mandir used to be done by boys from the hostel, right? And that is, if you speak to the students about that, that's a entire Bhagavatam in itself, how Swami would come and, you know, look at how that decoration would be done. Swami would see the safety of the students. There are stories of how Swami would come and stand on live wires so that others don't stand on it and get hurt. So in everything, if you look at it, it again goes back to that. What has Swami done in this whole thing? What is Swami doing for the villagers? What has Swami done for the students? He's doing for the students the same thing. Swami is saying, I'm just giving them love, confidence, all through my selflessness. And the blossoming happens all by itself. I think that itself is a beautiful message which is coming across in this entire chapter.
As the clock in our studio shows that it is time to close, I just feel that it will be so wonderful, Swami, if I can also reciprocate what you have done. As you said, Prem, Swami has just showered us with selflessness and love and encourage, and you know, whatever other word you call it, it's basically derived from his selfless love. Swami has just, without any kind of discrimination or distinction, has showered that selfless love on all, just like the sun showers its rays on all. The sun and its rays, Bhagwan and his grace, both are universal and have been showered on all. I just pray that, Swami, we also wake up to this fact and we also shower our love selflessly on you, Swami, because that is the only way our love can find fulfillment, as the Gopikas prayed. Forgive me if I'm going wrong in Telugu, but ye prema nosang Okay, I will not make an attempt. Basically, the Gopikas say, "Oh Krishna, what can we offer to you? What love you have filled in our hearts. That is the only thing we can say is ours, even though that also doesn't belong to us because you have only filled it in our heart. That same love we offer it back to you, O Krishna. Swami, nothing that we have belongs to us. You have showered it selflessly on us and therefore you don't stake any claim on it. But Swami, we want to sanctify it, fructify it, make it fulfilled in the best manner possible, and that's why we would like to offer all that love back unto your lotus feet." On that note, dear listeners, we'll bring this satsang to a close. We'll end with this song, on the other side of which you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
Namo Sai Deva Jaya Jaya Namo Prema Bhava.
Gama gama re gadi, gadi 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 gad హరి గమని రవ గమరి గరి సజీవ కోటి అనంతమీ ప్రపంచ వలయంలో జీవ కోటి అనంతమీ ప్రపంచ వలయంలో మానవ జన్మం ఎంతో విలువైనదిగా జీవకోటి అనంతమీ ప్రపంచ వలయంలో మానవ జన్మం ఎంతో విలువైనదిగా భగవంతుని గ్రహించే జ్ఞానమనే శక్తి భగవంతుని గ్రహించే జ్ఞానమనే శక్తి భగవంతుని గ్రహించే జ్ఞానమనే శక్తి పొందగలుగు జన్మ ఇదే అని చాటిన సాయి భగవంతుని గ్రహించే జ్ఞానమనే శక్తి పొందగలుగు జన్మ ఇదే అని చాటిన సాయి సాయినామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇహ పరాలను సగు సాధనం సాయినామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం
listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.